And how are we today for View from the End Zone Pit POV podcast on Sunday, the 22nd of April, and it looks like a great spring day. A beautiful Sunday morning down here in Maryland, and a good day to talk about Pit football, as always. First off, let me say thank you very much to everyone that wrote their condolences about my aunt in North Carolina. Not good. Say too much about this anymore, but you know what? I really appreciated it. It's a tough thing for me, a tough thing for my family down in North Carolina. She was my surrogate mother in a lot of ways. My mother died when I was 19, and my dad when I was 13. But anyway, thanks so much for all that. And I don't know when I'm going to go. They don't know when the memorial service is going to be, but whatever it is, I'm going to drop everything, obviously, and go down there. I'll be delivering the eulogy. And you know what? I'm going to talk about Pitt. That was a big part of her life, and every time I went down there, I got back in touch with them back in the late or mid-90s, after I'd been bouncing all around the world, basically, in the military. And then every time we got together, we talked about University of Pittsburgh and Pitt football. We watched the game whenever we had a chance. Usually it was the Pitt-West Virginia games, you know, Thanksgiving time, Penn State games before that sometimes. Anyway, so thanks for that. A couple things let's talk about. One of them is that we had a couple really interesting articles. Well, I shouldn't say that because I wrote them. But we had some really interesting discussions, I should say, on some of the articles I wrote the other day. And part of that is, I really love it when you guys kick in with your comments. And one of the things I want to say about how I look at the POV and how it's set up and how I want it to work is that I think my job is to put out some information and opinions of my own. And, you know, I obviously borrow a lot from all the other writers, from the Post-Gazette, Tribune Review, Rivals. I love Chris Peek's work, Jerry DiPiola over at the Trib. You know, and so what I do is I have a list of links that I go through every day. And I say, okay, this sounds interesting. And I try not to steal their stuff. But if I do steal it, I always put it in there. I usually put it in italics, and I put a link up to it so that it's attributed. But what it does most of the times, it gets me thinking about, oh, maybe I, you know, that's interesting. Let me think about this for a while, and then I do my research, and I talk about it. Well, part of that is, what I want to do is I want to put information out there, and then I really want to kind of step back from it, even though I'll comment every once in a while. But I want to step back from things so that you guys can take over the stage and you guys can interact with each other, and then I can read your opinions and you know, your thoughts about things. And that's what makes it, look, by far, I have the ability, it's kind of interesting, I have the ability to see what other kind of websites are doing. And I got to be honest with you, we are way, way past anyone else as far as comments goes. And I don't know about readership. I think we're way past readership too, though, in most of them. But certainly it with comments. I mean, we average 130 comments, almost 130 comments an article over almost 2-year period now. It's pretty amazing, guys. And you know, you look at other blogs like Pitt Blather. Now, Pitt Blather used to have a lot, too. It's a little bit less now because Chaz isn't writing as much. But Dokish is Panther Prey or the Rival stuff. And, you know, message boards are one thing. Those are usually one-liners, two-liners. People put their immediate thoughts up. But, I mean, as far as what we have on the POV, and I'm not bragging, I'm just saying this because it's in context to what my point here is that I throw stuff up, and then the beauty of it is you guys respond. Now, Ike and I, you know, I understand that statistics are one way of looking at things, but of anything in life that we deal with, and I'm talking about religion, politics, sports, drama, you know, socioeconomic stuff, anything you want to talk about, except for maybe economics, maybe. Sports is all about numbers. It's what it is. It is about numbers. It has been that way forever, and it is always that way. Whenever you read articles about, unless you're reading an article about it in about a person-specific writing, like a biography or an interview with a person, unless you're reading that, everything else has to do with statistics, because that's how we measure things in sports. And this is what it is. Now, I understand full well that statistics do not tell the whole story. But what I do is, when I throw my opinions up or whatever it is, I put a lot of statistics up, because that gives you guys an idea of why I'm saying what I'm saying. Now, I made a comment just this morning, I think, about this same topic about statistics. And one of the things I wrote, it was in response to one of Ike's comments, is that, you know, if the way I look at things is, when you look at the body of work, when you're talking about sports, or let's say pit football, I think statistics are very much akin to the skeleton of the discussion. They're the basic facts. Statistics are facts. Now, how you look at those and how you discuss those are really what builds that out. They're the muscle, the sinew, and then your opinions are the skin. Because what I see from you guys, when you come back on the POV and start discussing stuff, I see your opinions, and that is the skin of the body. So that might be a weird visual, but that's how I look. Now, I know full well that when you look at Pitt's all-time quarterbacks and their production numbers, their statistics, production, right? You see that Tino Cinceri's right behind Danny Marino. He has like 9 yards less passing than Dan Marino does. Now, every single Pitt fan that has a working cell in their brain knows that Tino Cinceri was nowhere near Danny Marino when it comes to being an adequate and great quarterback. And by the way, I think Marino was a very, very good quarterback. I do. I don't think, of course I wasn't here. I'll talk about that later. But anyway. So that would be a case of throwing a statistic out and knowing, if I would do that, if I would say, look, since Aries is as good as Marino, then I would be completely wrong and I would be using statistics in a dishonest way. I believe in a dishonest way. But then again, there is no denying that he is 9 yards or 7 yards behind Marino in passing. But, you know, he played more games, whatever it is. So I understand that. Now, one of the points that Ike made, And I understand, I get this too, is that you can't take certain things out. Well, I disagree with that. There's two things. You look at the body of the work, and it's one, the body of the work, let's say Darren Hall is a good example. Darren Hall had something like 600 and, let me see, I think I wrote this down. He had something like 600 and some rushing yards, right? But on 128 carries. So, hold on one second. I want to look this up to make sure. Okay, here it is. Darren Hall played 12 games, had 128 attempts, 660 yards, lost 32, so he had a net of 628. 4.9 yards per carry and 9 touchdowns. You know what? On the face of that, that looks pretty good. The benchmark for a running back is 0.5. Dorsett was almost 0.6. I think Dorsett was 5.9. Connor was 5.7 over his career. So 5.0 is a good running back. Darren Hall on the face of it, 4.9. Now, my point is, how did he do overall carrying the ball? And I think that you would be dishonest if you looked at that and said, well, yeah, he averaged 4.9. The truth was, he was nowhere near 4.9 when he touched the ball. He had two great runs against Duke, a 76-yarder and a 92-yarder. You take those away. Now, it's not like I'm not erasing them from memory. He did those, and he scored touchdowns on those, and they helped us win that game. That was wonderful. But when you're talking about him as a running back last year, I think you take those two out, and you say, okay, because really, 128 carries, you take two away, that's only 2.5 percent of his carries or whatever. Not even that, really. So anyway, then all of a sudden you drop him 160 some yards, and his on the other 126 carries, he only averaged 3.6. Now 3.6 is not good. And that's really the bulk of the work we got from Darren Hall. The bulk of the work we got from Darren Hall, 126 out of 128 carries. Those 126 carries, he was subpar by a lot. You do not want a 3.9 running back to be your leading running back, and that's what we're going to have. Okay? So statistics can tell a lot of different stories depending how you explain them, but you have to explain them, and I know that. So I get you that you guys think all I do is throw stats up, but when I do that, I throw stats up, and I also try to explain the context of why I'm putting statistics up. Because they don't, on the face of them, they don't tell the whole story. Now, if you threw statistics out completely, then, you know, then it's total opinion. I could say, well, yeah, Darren Hall's a great running back. Well, show me he's a great running back. Same with Max Brown. You know, if you look at Max Brown's stats last year, it's pretty interesting. You would say on the face of it, he's not that bad of a passer, really. You know, he had he played 5.5 games. It says 6 games here. He had 142-point rating. You know, he threw 135, completed 96, 71%. You would think that's all well and good. 5 touchdowns, 997 yards. You know, and he averaged 166.17. But what was his value to the team? His value to the team was almost nil because he played one game, he threw for 410 yards and 4 touchdowns against literally, I think it was number 127 or 129 ranked passing defense. Rice had the worst passing defense, non-Power 5 team, worst passing defense, and non-ACC team, so it didn't matter in an ACC conference. That skewed his season completely. Take that away, and he was terrible. He was terrible. He didn't throw a single touchdown except he in regulation play. Other than those 4 touchdowns he had against Rice, in all those other games, he didn't have one touchdown in regulation play. He did have the touchdown that won the game against YSU in overtime. But it was terrible. And you look at his passing rating after that. If you take his quarterback efficiency rating and you take that Rice game out, it was horrendous. And we knew it was horrendous. So this is another thing when I say when you use stats, you have to look at the stats and say, well, are they valid or are they not valid? And if they're not, you have to talk about that. 10 years from now, someone's going to look at the 2017 season and go, wow, Hall was a 4.9 runner. And Max Brown was a 147 efficiency, which is very good, by the way. 147 is good, is really good quarterback efficiency rating. And they're going to go, how did these guys lose games? Well, we know how they lost. We know how we lost games. We had a crap running game overall. And Max Brown couldn't play quarterback in a D1 level. He couldn't. Ben DiNucci played much better than Max Brown did. But you wouldn't know it looking at the stats, would you? So I just wanted to get that out of the way because I'm going to keep doing it. The only way to write articles, really, unless I have a chance to interview guys like, you know, Chris Peek and DiPaolo, they can go to every practice. They can interview people. They always have interview sessions afterwards. They can go there for the first 15 or 25 minutes or whatever it is now. I think it's even getting less under Pat Narduzzi's third, fourth year. But anyway, they can sit around and they can talk to everyone else, and they have fodder for articles. They have fertile grounds, I should say, for writing stuff. And so their writing style is different than mine because they have the ability to interview people and talk about that. I don't have that ability. I live 250 miles away. Okay, so this is my writing style, and I think it's served us well over the years. Now, again, I would not throw stats out unless I felt they meant something. For instance, the other day, I put those stats up about our comparison of the offensive lines. Now, if I would just put the 2017 offensive line up there, you know, like the sacks allowed, TFLs allowed, rushing yards per game, rushing yards per carry, passing yards per game, and passing efficiency. To me, those are the six, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Those are the six key indicators on how well, first of all, it also depends on your running backs and your quarterback, how well they play. But really, those are the key indicators of how well an offensive line did. Well, you know, if I would just put up 2017s, it would be pretty bad, which it was. It was. They were 101st in sacks allowed, 99th in tackles for loss allowed. They were 85th in rushing, 73rd in passing, which again, in that Rice game, skews that completely. And our passing efficiency was 74th. But the again, that Rice game skewed that. But the point was, my articles about how was it as opposed to the other couple years under Pat Narduzzi. I only went back 2 years. I didn't go all the way back to 2000. I don't know, 15, 16, 17, excuse me. So you put those stats up and you talk about them. Okay? Now, if I would just throw that table up and say, here it is, and never talk about it and not elucidate or enlighten, then it would be ridiculous. So, okay, I just wanted to touch base on that because, you know, I'm going to keep using stats, and I think that's how you get your point across in a lot of ways. But, again, I think the best comparison in the world is looking at our past quarterbacks, and you look at Marino and Sunseri, and a lot of ways, they're a lot alike in a lot of ways in statistics. But, you know, playing is night and day, right? So, okay. Now, this is interesting. I was looking at the all-time best players, too. And one of the things about the all-time best players, and I realized when I say what I do about Dan Marino, I have to make a caveat. I have to make a little explanation. I only saw him play one game, and that was on television, because the whole time he was playing, I was overseas. I was either in Hawaii or Alaska, and when I joined the military in 78, almost, yeah, 78, so September 78, so I missed all that season, and then I didn't come back to the East Coast when I could really get kind of back into, you know, pit football and be close enough to go to a game or two until 1998. And then even then, I still followed it, but I didn't really catch on. I didn't really get super interested until Wonstadt was hired. That was when I started really getting on the message boards and writing. And then, of course, Chaz Rich over at the Pit Blather asked me to go ahead and write for him. So when we talk about the best players, and my thing about Marino is I understand that you guys that watched him probably felt he's great, he's fantastic. And he was, you know, 46 and what, 5 or 6 or whatever it was. The wins were crazy, crazy good. And so, that, you know, I have to say that part of my opinion is that if I sat and watched him every game, I might feel differently about it. But you can't get away from those interceptions. I mean, and I think that if he had, I really do believe that a lot of it, if we want to talk about what's conceptual or contextual in sports and contextual in football and pit football in particular, then you have to look at what the surrounding cast is like. Who knows what Sunseri could have done if he had the same offensive coordinator and this and a decent offensive line. He had, I think it was 1 year he had a good offensive line in front of him. But Marino had the chance to play really with the same cast of characters. And if they weren't the same, they were getting, like those offensive linemen especially, and running backs, if they weren't the same, they were getting replaced by people of equal quality. And they were fantastic. So what would Danny Marino have done if he was on Todd Graham and Paul Chryst's team? He might have been like, you know, Rod Rutherford or Alex Van Pelt that didn't win a ton of games because he didn't have a great cast around him. But he was a great quarterback. But I think he was a much better NFL quarterback than he was a college quarterback. But I don't know. Like I said, you guys watched him, I didn't. Now, I had a chance to watch every game Doris had played at home. And I think I went down to the Sugar Bowl. So, that, you know, and this is a funny thing. When we talk about running backs, we just got into it a little bit this morning and last night on the comments. If you never watch Tony Dorsett in person, I hate to say it, but you know what you're talking about. I shouldn't say it that way. If you've never watched Tony Dorsett play football in person, then you really don't understand what we mean when we say he's incomparable, the guys that had watched him in person. It was a different cat, man, I'm telling you. It was like every time that P pitched, and we did a lot of pitch outs to him, and a handoffs, but a lot of pitch outs. Every time you pitched the ball to him, I mean, we automatically stood up. It was like you automatically stood up because you figure, here he goes. I can't remember any other running back, not McCoy, not anybody at Pitt that had that kind of impact on games. I mean, defenses were scared. They were so scared of him at Notre Dame. They let the grass grow to 3 inches long. That 3 inches long is I was going to say something dirty, but 3 inches long is big. And when, excuse me, I'm cracking myself up, when it comes to lawn care. But really, they did that to slow him down. He went for like, that's not the 303 game. I think that was a 276-yard game he had. So he was special. And I'm sure, I never saw Fitzgerald play, and I'm sure it was the same way with Larry Fitz. When he went out there and the ball was up in the air, I'm sure all the fans were going, here you go, yay. They were two different kind of players. Hugh Green was like that on defense too. Man, oh man, every snap you figure someone's going to get tackled hard by Hugh Green. He should have won the Heisman Trophy, I think. Now, and I think Fitzgerald should have too. And I don't remember the name of the, was it Ron Cook that didn't vote for him? One of the guys, sports writers, didn't vote for him, and he lost to that freaking idiot from the guy that couldn't do a thing really at Oklahoma. So he was not that good of a quarterback. Anyway, so when we talk about the all-time best players, and then again, none of us were around back in the 20s and 30s when Pitt played, but I did relate that story about my family. That's all I heard about when I was kids. All my aunts and uncles went to Pitt right before World War II, and that's when Marshall Goldberg and Jock Sutherland were there. And, Pitt was awesome. Pitt was awesome back then. I remember when I was a kid, excuse me, my dad used to go to Frankie, he would go to the university club for lunch most of the time, but anyway, he would go to Frankie Gustine's and drink beer with Frankie. He knew Frankie Gustine down there in the bar. So I kind of would go down there with my dad sometimes, and when I was a student, I kind of hung out. Gustine's was kind of my place. And I remember talking to one of my dad's old friends. He was one of my dad's professors, I think. And we were talking about what Pitt football was like back in those days, and he was saying it was it because there was no Steelers. I mean, it was the Steagles or something like that. I mean, I don't even know if they were around. But college football, it's interesting how sports changed. Back in my parents' day and before, the big sports in America were horse racing, boxing, and college football, and baseball. But really, those were the big ones. And boxing and horse racing, I go down to Laurel Racetrack every once in a while down here because it's here. And that's it. I mean, if you guys not having a chance to go to a racetrack lately, especially if you live in Maryland, they rebuilt Laurel. It's beautiful. Now, I do $2 bets. I mean, I don't expect to win anything. I just go, my wife and I go on a sunny day because it's nice. You hang out there for 3 or 4 hours. You talk and you watch, go down to the paddock and you look at the horses. And then my wife's actually really good at looking at horse flesh. And then she goes, I'm going to bet that one. She wins money. I can't believe it. But, so that's how sports have changed. But college football was huge. It was as big as baseball, I think. And it was huge. But pro football wasn't around. Basketball wasn't around at all. Hockey wasn't a big deal. When you had Pitt winning national championships in football, it was a big deal. It was a big deal. Now, I know for your young kids, I guess, that hadn't heard these stories, or younger people that hadn't heard those kind of stories from parents, you might think, that was in the dust, dust age, or that was in the stone age, or whatever it is. But, we also had that article that we talked to, that John Baranowski wrote about, what Pitt's been like in the last 30 years. And it's really kind of sad. It is sad because we are a shadow of what we were, even in the 76 to 80, whatever, 70, So, you know, 74 and 75, we were 73, 74, 75. 73, 74, we were better than we were before because we were terrible before that. In the years before majors got here, we were terrible. But they were average. They were good. I mean, now we would say they were average years or what a decent years. But for us back then, it was a big deal. And then, of course, 75, we did really well. And then 76, we won the national championship. Jackie Sherrill took over, and we had those 11-1 seasons. But that's a blink in the eye when you look back at the history of 100 years of Pitt football. Really, it's a blink in the eye. And us, fans now, those were, you know, the kids that are going to school in the 90s and the 2000s, and now 76 to 80s, it's a whole different generation. For my generation, that was a big deal. We were at Pitt then. For their generation, it's like, okay, we had the really way back with Sutherland, then we had the way back with majors, and now, you know, this is what Pitt football is for them. So that's good. I mean, it's nice. Pitt football is what it is. You know, and I think that, I think it's kind of interesting. I know sometimes, I mention this every podcast, I know, you know, people call me pessimistic, but you know what? I kind of see things with a big picture. The picture. Picture is a Pittsburgh way of saying it. I kind of see the big picture because we haven't been very good. And to think that all of a sudden we're going to become this top 10 team years and years in a row, I think is a pipe dream. I really believe that. But I'm a realist, guys. I mean, I am. I am a realist. I don't believe in stuff that I don't believe in. I don't say it if I don't believe it. And I think that we could be a top 20 team, 25 team every year. I think that could happen with the right coach and the right recruiting. It's all about recruiting. It really is. It's about getting, 50-50, getting a great coach that really knows what he's doing and hiring a good staff. And you don't have to pay a ton of money to get a good staff. You don't have to pay tons and tons of money. We pay Jim Huber nothing. And he was the best offensive line coach we had since the other really good offensive line coach we had. His name's, you know, slipping my mind right now. But, you know, so I wouldn't say Pitt is what it is. I don't think we're 5-7, continual 5-17. I don't think we are. I think we are an 7-9 win team if we have the right things come together. And I'll tell you something, and I know, Ike and I, some other guys go back and forth on this, but we blew such a great chance in 2016. We blew that chance, man. I'm telling you, with that offense we had, if we would have had even last year's defense, and last year's defense wasn't that great, guys. It really wasn't. It wasn't very good defense except for two games at the end of the year. But If we would have had even last year's defense, we might have had 1-9 or 10, and possibly if we had a better, even a decent, even a good defense, we would have won 11 games, might have been in the playoffs. I really, truly believe that. We blew that game against Northwestern. We would have had 9 wins. We would have been, and by my figuring, and I really crunched these numbers and looked at this very closely, by my figuring, we would have been between number 17 and number 15 in the nation at the end of that year if we would have won that bowl game. Now, we didn't win it, but if we would have won that, our recruiting would be different. I firmly believe that. I believe if we would have ended up number 15 in 2016, number 17 or 15 in 2016, Our 2017-2018 recruiting would be much, much better than it's been. Much better. We would have gotten the blue chippers. But, you know, it was another 8-5 team, and then you followed up with a 5-7 team, and, you know, it's hard to convince really good, really solid. We probably have some solid players in the recruiting ranks. I mean, I think we do. I think we have some solid players. But Pitt does not win with solid players, guys. Pitt wins with stars. And I think we would have had some of those real good blue chippers. When you only get one or two, four stars and no 5 stars a year, the reality of recruiting is that a third to a half of your 4 stars are not going to make it through 4 years anyway. And we've seen that at Pitt all the time. So the more you get, the more you have a chance of one or two or three or four to stick and play well. I mean, people are talking about Darren Hall like he's a really good running back. He was a four-star. Tyler Boyd was a four-star. Bookser's a four-star. You know, these are the kids you need to play well. You need, you know, and I'm not talking about transfers. And I want to make this clear because I think it's a whole different world. High school recruiting is a whole different world than getting kids to transfer in from JUCO, community college, or a transfer from another school. It's a whole different world. When you get to fight to get blue chippers, to fight to get the really good recruits out of high school, you're fighting against hundreds of other colleges. When you're getting guys like Chase Brown or this offensive lineman from Ventura Community College, nobody else was trying to get these kids. Maybe one or two other teams. Maybe one or two. You're not recruiting JUCOs and community college. You're not recruiting them. When you talk about recruiting, you're talking about high school recruiting, and that's where the rubber meets the road when you're building a football team. When you get JUCOs, community college, you are plugging gaps because you didn't recruit, or the coach before you didn't recruit well in positions. But let's not kid ourselves. A team is going to be a strong team and a strong program through high school recruiting. And not everybody plugs transfers in like we do. Not everybody does. I could do some research on this, but I think if you look around at all the colleges, I think Pitt gets way more transfers in the last 3 years than any other school has. Not way more than any other school, I'm exaggerating. But I think we get more than most. More than most. And it's a hit and miss proposition, folks. You know, look at the 5 stars we've had come in. We've had Clark didn't do anything for us. Okay, we have Ricky Town. I don't know. We'll see what he does. You know, we have 4-star Hendricks. Now, he was a 4-star coming out of high school. That doesn't mean anything. If he would have come to Pitt as a 4-star out of high school, maybe he would have played well. Who knows? He went to Tennessee. He didn't do anything. And he comes here. I don't think he's done anything. Again, we'll see about that. I'm not sold on Hendricks. We had Max Brown, 5-star. You know, just because these kids were 5-stars coming out of high school doesn't mean they're 5-stars coming to Pitt. What happens? Those stars deflate really quickly when they screw up in the other schools they were at. But we keep getting these kids, these vagabonds. I mean, you know, it's okay to get kids, guys in, I guess, if you have to. But, you know, let me say this very clearly. That coaching staff is in a panic mode over the offensive line. It is in a panic mode. We are losing. Let's talk about this for a minute. Last year, we 5 players on the offensive line, times 12, right? 12 games, 60 possible starts. 38 of those starts are gone. 22 of those starts are returning in two players, Bookser and Morrissey at center. We lost Officer, Jared Jones-Smith, and Hodges. Okay? Look at the All-ACC team last year. We had only two on the whole team. The whole special teams, offense, and defense. We had two first teams. We had O'Neal as an offensive lineman. No other offensive lineman at all. No, none others. We had Winslow as a punter, special teams. We had Henderson as a special teams player, second string. He was a second string. And we had a third string player in Devontae Maddox, a defensive back. All those kids are gone, every one of them. Now, for honorable mention, so you have first, second, and third team. Now you go down into honorable mention. You have Bookser. He's coming back. Officer was honorable mention. He's gone. Idu was coming back, and Whitehead's gone. So all the guys that were singled out for postseason honors are gone, except for Idu and Bookser. We have 2 guys on the team that were worthy of all-conference mention, even honorable mention. Guys, we do not have a lot of returning talent on this team. Now, we have unknown talent. And there's going to be talent that's unknown out there. Now, I know we're putting our eggs in a basket with Virginus, but let's hope. Let's keep our fingers crossed. And we need to have a defensive end. We need to have someone really strong on the opposite end other than Hendricks. Because unless he completely changes his game, he was ineffective last year. Our defense was not that good last year, guys. I mean, we are really pinning our hopes on how they played the last two games. But then again, we lost some players off that defense. Not a lot. We have a lot of... I'm much more optimistic about the defense this year than I have been in any other year. It might sound like I'm not, but I am. I really am. And I think it's going to be a decent defense. But I think a lot of people are expecting it to be a really good defense, and I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to have pressure on the quarterback that we need. And I've said it before, but any defensive line that starts Shane Roy for 12 games in a row, if we can't replace a guy like Shane Roy, who was average, not even average at best, then there's a problem there. I mean, what happened to Watts? What happened to Camp? And maybe Twyman will come up and do some things, but what happened to these kids that were highly rated coming out of high school? Instead, we have a guy that bounced around doing hardly anything and started his last 2 years. Now, you know, it sounds like I'm picking on him, and I'm not. I'm not picking on him. I'm being brutally honest. I think any defensive line that starts Shane Roy in the middle of it is going to have problems. And if we can't find a replacement for him, that means we don't have anywhere near the depth in the defensive line that people are talking about. And if you don't have that pressure on the quarterback, we've seen this 3 years in a row now. If you don't have pressure on that quarterback, which Narduzzi's defenses are predicated on, then I think we're going to have a tough time with the defensive backfield and the linebackers covering passes. But I do think we're going to have more talent in the defensive backfield. I don't know what Paris Ford is going to be like. I am keeping my fingers crossed he is as good as advertised, because we need that. And he was picking passes off in spring drills. So that's good. And DeMar Hamlin played pretty well. He's a good ball player, you know. And now we're going to have, we're going to have a couple other guys in there. Maddox was a good one. He was good last year. He was the best defensive back we had last year. He's going to be gone. Of course, this is what happens when you graduate, right? So it's the beauty of college football. You keep seeing these new guys come up. So anyway. You know, go back to the defensive backfield for a second. We have 11 returning lettermen and 7 players with starting experience. So that's pretty deep. Dane Jackson is a good one. He's a good one. I know people are really high on Jason Pinnick, and he played very well. Damari Mathis played well. But really, I think it's going to be Dane Jackson's going to be there. It's going to be Damar Hamlin at free safety. I believe that Paris Ford, they moved over to the cornerback position. So it'll be Jackson and Ford. It'll be Hamlin and probably maybe Phil Campbell. If they start Briggs, that's a problem. But maybe Theron Coleman or Bryson Gardner could slide over. So I think there's some good frontline talent there. Some good frontline talent. See, and the thing is, what I think about the difference between that, and I don't know about the linebackers because I don't really know what, you know, I don't really know what, guys like Chase Pine are capable of doing. I know that, you know, we have a lot of hope for them. We have a lot of hope for Reynolds and Jalen Williams hasn't really done much. And McKee, I don't know what he's going to do. But we have Chase Pine and, you know, Brightwell, Elias Reynolds, Adubu, Virginus, and Zeiss. So they might do pretty well. But I think that I'm not sure about the depth we have at defensive back. I think other people think that we have a really good depth there, so I'm going to have to kind of take their opinion about that. But I think our defensive line, I don't see any depth at all there. Weaver and Hendricks are going to be the defensive ends. Shane Roy, we got to hope Twyman takes over. That's it. That's all I'm going to say. If Twyman doesn't take over that nose tackle position, Or maybe a Watzer camp moves over. Rashad Wheeler, maybe, I don't know, he's a tackle. But someone's going to have to get in there and kick Roy out of that starting lineup, I think. But I don't think we have the depth on the defensive line that we need either. Because I think they're going to be on the field a lot. That's another thing people aren't really talking about. We talked about how much the defense was on the field last, and they were burnt out at the end of some games last year. They were tired. Boy, they were up for that whole Miami game, though. That was a wonderful game to watch. But the defense was, they were lagging, and especially against North Carolina, they were lagging in the fourth quarter. Because they had to keep, there was a close game. You know, Conklin kept those starters in there. And when you keep your starters in 60 minutes, or, you know, however long they're on defense, usually it's 33 to 27 minutes, they're going to get burned out if they're not rotating people in. And I'm not sure we're going to have the people to rotate in on the defensive line or in the backfield. Because I don't think our offense is going to do anything. I mean, I think we're going to have a decent passing game. But I'm very worried about our offense. I don't think the running backs are there. I don't... Who knows about... I mean, you know, when you hear the staff members start saying... And the when you hear staff members on the coaching staff and the head coach and then the beat writers start talking about where they feel like there's going to be problems, and usually these guys are always really upbeat, there's two things I've noticed this spring that they're being really kind of brutally honest about. The offensive line, in the beginning of it, it was like, oh, no, everything's fine, everything's all right. Now at the end of it, after that spring game and everything, they're starting to go, okay, this is a problem. I mean, even Peak, who's pretty optimistic in a lot of ways, he's kind of changed his tune on the offensive line. And, you know, Narduzzi rolled back his statement, by the way, where he said, oh, there's a better pass protection than we had. They're better right now than our team was the whole year last year. He actually said that. And he rolled that back fast. He said, well, maybe I was a little bit, you know, jumped the gun a little bit on that one. But, When you hear these guys start talking about the wide receivers and having, you know, maybe we have a problem at wide receiver, that's pretty important. We lost the 1 and 2. Of course, Lopes is back. Rara Lopes is back. He's a good one out of the slot. But Wea, and even, you know, Henderson and Wea were not good receivers, but they were our best receivers. We had a lot of guys go backwards last year. That's why in the last podcast I said we had something going on last year. Something was going on that we didn't know, we didn't see, because it's very unusual for your three best players, really, Wea, O'Neal, and Whitehead, to roll back their play like they did last year. Now, O'Neal, I think, made that number one first team all ACC based on really his play in the year before. And he didn't play terribly last year, but he did not play up to the level he played as a sophomore by any means. And Whitehead sure as hell didn't, even though he missed a game or three games. But after that, he didn't play well, and Wayne didn't play well at all, really. I mean, forget about that no touchdown against Virginia Tech. Overall, his play was great. And Henderson didn't play well, so it was four players. Four players that we were depending on to really be shining stars on offense, one on defense, to really help our team. And boy, they all rolled their play back so much, we couldn't function, hardly. On offense, I don't think we could. So I'm worried about our offense. Okay. Let me see. I had some other notes here. Let me see what my other notes say here. Cherry picking issues. Well, you know what? That's about it. I'm at 44 minutes. I think that defense is going to be really fun to watch this year because I think it's going to be faster. It's going to be faster. Virginus is fast. He's a fast white kid. You know, you don't think of that, right? Why is it we can't say that? He's a fast white kid. I said that. I wrote that the other day, last year I wrote that, and someone called me up. Well, why do you have to call him white? Well, that's what he is. And usually they're not that fast, right? But he's a quick one. He has that quick twitch, you know, big first step. And he can get in there. If he plays the way he's capable of playing, and then Zeiss played okay toward the end of the year. I don't think he's all that great. But he can play. And I like Adewu. I don't know why. Some people are really down on him. But he's a solid ball player. He's a solid ball player, and he gets more, he had more. I think he might have led the team in sacks. Hold on a second. Yeah, Iduwu, he led the team in tackles, led the team in sacks, led the team in tackles for loss. Two pass breakups, two quarterback hurries. I mean, that kid played well, man. He played well. So he had 14.5 tackles behind line of scrimmage. He's no Ewan Price. You know what? If we could use anyone on defense, one person on defense, I'd take Ewan Price. If I could have one person back from the last few years, I'd take Ewan Price at that defense end position. He then, you know, put Weaver in and get rid of Hedricks. But okay, but I think our defense is going to be fun to watch. I'm not that down on defense. I'm just saying I don't think it's going to be great. My thing is, as long as it's good enough to hold the other team under 23 points. We were 26.6 last year, and that's pretty high, guys. It really is pretty high. If we can hold them down to 21 to 23, but our special teams are not that good this year. I really, Kessman was not that great of a field goal. He could kick some long ones, but he's not. He was a 500 kicker. And boy, our punter's got it. Our punter has got to get it together. Because to me, this really kind of surprises me, when a lot of teams don't even use scholarships on the punter and the kicker. But I think, look, when your kicker goes out there and your punter goes out there, they're there to do a pretty damn important job, either to get 3 points or to knock the kickoff receiving team back past that 25-yard line. And your punter, you can talk as much as you want about defense, but every time you get a good punt, you're knocking that team back 40 yards, 45 yards. If you don't have a good punter, then you're shortening the field for those guys. You want that field as long as it can possibly be. I think a punter is one of the most important players on the team. I mean, you talk about a guy, we can hold him to 3 yards or whatever, but you know what? Give me that guy that puts him back 45 yards like Winslow did. He was a good player. Okay. Anyway, offense is a worry for me, and it's going to be a worry for me until we go into the fall. And if we put Mike Herndon on the offensive line, Herndon on offense, Roy on defense, that'd be a weird one, okay. All right, thanks a lot anyway. And I want to get back to the beginning what I said. Thanks so much about my aunt, too. I take all this stuff to heart, and I really appreciate it. And when I do go down to North Carolina, I'll let you guys know, and please, you know, rip off an article or two. It's really not a hard thing to do. Some of the comments you people write are almost articles in themselves. Just send me if you're going to write a really long comment, think about sending it to me via email. I'll go ahead and put photos and crap and stuff, and I'll maybe flesh out some of the, you know, stuff you do with some stats and stuff like that, and it's an article. Ba-boom, you wrote an article. All right, guys, be safe this week. This is Reed signing off from the POV. Hail to Pitt.